You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, lads.
Hello. Guys, how about that last damn episode of Game of Thrones?
Oh, didn't see it.
Oh, my God.
Bob, what happened?
Oh, my God.
What did I do? I called Bob, so I happened to actually see the episode as it aired, which is so unbelievably rare for me with
my
wacky schedule.
Very rare.
So I literally call Bob up, and I'm like, Bob, did you just see the Game of Thrones episode? Bob's like, no, I didn't. I'm like, oh my God, Bob, this episode was made for you. You're going to love it. It was so epic. That was, I think, the best Game of Thrones episode so far.
I agree. And it was funny, Jay, because after you said that to me, I knew, okay, made for Bob, there's got to be zombies, White Walkers, or something like that, or tons of nudity, something like that that he knew I would really like.
Or nanosex.
So even knowing that and going in, I had no real idea that it would be just this epic 20-minute-long scene of zombies and White Walkers, and it was fantastic, beyond epic. I was just laughing and giggling the whole time. They just kicked ass. And that I read about technically what went on behind the scenes. That was the biggest, most difficult battle they have ever done in what, 4 or 5 seasons now? It took 4 months to film that, to film those 20 minutes. Four months. Steve, did you know this? They had to film every fight scene 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
One was just the actor with nobody, which was difficult because you had to, imagine fighting with no one there. And then the other one was fighting an actor in a green suit for the special effects. And then the last time it was fighting an actor in makeup. Mm-hmm. So they used all those three and they picked like the best one for certain fights and whatever. The guy said it was grueling, but it was so worth it. It was fantastic. And not in the books.
It was referred to in the books, but that
sounds rather visual.
Happened off camera. It was talked
between
about.
Between the pages.
But it wasn't described, in the books. It was just that it had happened. So it's great. I mean, it was an excellent choice. First of all, I'm really enjoying the series, both in the books and on HBO. But, the downside is that it's taking so long for stuff to happen. And, Martin teases you with this awesome plot line about the White Walkers in the very first chapter of the first book. And then it's just so agonizingly slow in coming. And so, the giving us some real meat was awesome. Just giving us that scene that was only hinted at in the books was, I think, a great choice.
And how about those zombie kids? That's actually, they took a chance there because generally you want to stay away from zombie kids. That's just, it's just too.
That's just Bob's law.
No, that's just a pet. I don't care at all. What you could zombify a bacteria for all I care. No, but it's generally a good idea to stay away from that because it just hits too close to home and it's not good. But so they just had a brief scene, bam, just not too long with a bunch of like not very young, maybe early teens. And that one kid was like the coolest zombie in the entire place. He was fantastic. He looked so creepy and nasty.
Yeah, kids nowadays probably didn't have to act too hard for that scene.
Now the creep factor was really high, which is hard these days. I mean, we're so jaded. It's really hard for me to feel like a scene is genuinely creepy. Well done. Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
All right, guys. This week in Forgotten Superheroes of Science is Margaret Hamilton, not the witch. She was a software engineer. Yes, Wizard of Oz.
She
was a software engineer pioneer who, including her team, helped prevent an aborted first landing on the moon.
How'd she
ever
do
hear
that?
Of her? Well, you will see. Hamilton was the director of the software engineering division of the MIT Instrumentation Laboratory, and they worked on the onboard guidance software that helped us land on the moon. And this software, I didn't realize this, was one of the first times that pure software was allowed to handle such a real-time mission-critical task. It was really, a little scary because they'd never really done anything quite like this before. Now remember, this task that she was given, her and her team, this was given before you could almost literally find any computer science or software engineering courses in any school. They just weren't really offered at that time. She was self-taught. She was a mathematician before that. And in fact, she coined the term software engineering. I did not know that. She said, I began to use the term software engineering to distinguish it from hardware and other kinds of engineering. When I first started using this phrase, it was considered to be quite amusing. It was an ongoing joke for a long time, which is funny because they figured, oh, software engineering, that's, you know, that was kind of, you know, oxymoronic. But no, it's not. It really, of course, is a legit branch of engineering, and it's a huge gargantuan industry today. In this role that she played, she was among the first to develop critical concepts like asynchronous software, priority scheduling, end-to-end testing, and human-in-the-loop decision capability. And much of those things became later on a bedrock for ultra-reliable software design that are used in critical life-dependent systems. Notably, it was used in subsequent NASA programs and including Skylab as well. So she was a real pioneer. I'm assuming a lot of you guys probably heard that the landing module was running, you know, almost running out of fuel before they landed. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fairly common story that they cut it really close. But did you know that 3 minutes before touchdown, the software that this team and Margaret worked on triggered multiple alerts that freaked everybody out? Uh-huh. They were getting these nasty errors and they're like, holy crap, what does this mean? And should we abort because of it? And so it turned out afterwards, after the dust settled, they finally found out what happened. What happened was that Buzz Aldrin had a checklist of things to do. Bam, 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 one, two, three, in order. Critical things that he had to do, but that checklist was in error. There was a mistake in that checklist. It asked him to turn on the rendezvous radar system, which was not needed in order to land. So it was too early. It was placed too early in that checklist. But of course, he was following the checklist and he turned it on, and that almost ended in disaster because when that radar was turned on, it assaulted the computer with too much extra work, which caused overflow errors. For a lot of computers, even today, they, you know, computers will not be happy with that or even seize up or stop working totally.
Bob, did he get the equivalent of the blue screen of death?
No.
Can you imagine that when you're trying to land on the moon?
Oh, my God, no. That would be scary. No, but it really was just like these, you know, these 302 errors and things. But they, you know, there was beeping noises and they – and
people were
a little freaked out, especially when you're minutes away from landing on the moon. Hello.
Yeah.
It's the last thing you want to hear. So what happened was that Hamilton and her team, they had designed the system to be so robust that this is what it did. It basically ignored those low-level requests, and it focused on the top priority tasks at hand that the navigation computer was doing, namely landing the craft. So that pretty much saved the day. And also, this software could oxymoronically immediately reboot to flush the data. I mean, those are two words you don't hear together, right? Immediate and rebooting. But this was able to reboot itself.
Wow.
Almost instantaneously. So they quickly realized when this was happening that these were the types of errors that they could ignore, not worry about, because they were going to be discarded by the computer to focus on the important stuff.
Oh.
And that they could then proceed with the landing and preventing an aborted landing or worse. I mean, who knows? That's it. So remember Margaret Hamilton, the Wizard of Oz witch, and the one I was just talking about. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing the role of bit line wires in rope core memory.
What's amazing to me is that 40 plus years later, computer programs are not smart enough to do what she figured out back then. You know what I mean? You guys have had this experience, right, where you tell the computer to do something like copy files or whatever. You know it's going to take an hour or two. And it runs into a problem. Like, do you really want to move this file or whatever? And it stops
the whole thing.
It stops the whole thing. Like, it's not smart enough. They haven't figured out to just put that aside, complete the task that you're doing. And then at the end of it, you can ask me, hey, did you want to do this one file? I put it aside for you. You know, that doesn't seem so amazing,
right,
that a computer shouldn't be able to do it. But I don't understand. Jay, this is what you do for a living, right? I know you're involved with computers. Why? That little stuff like that drives me crazy. And I
so
don't
you're
know,
saying, like, drive? Are you saying, like, when the computer, like, locks up and only lets you do, all it lets you do is make that seemingly non-important decision and everything
yes.
else stops?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, Steve. It's a hard thing to crack, because for some reason, the people that made the operating systems, you know, a lot of this is built into the OS.
It's exactly like saying that we cannot take off the ship until we have our full complement of lemon soaked napkins.
You know? Oh my God, what a great analogy. That's great.
That's what it is. It's like we have this little thing. I'm going to stop the whole process until you answer this stupid question about this one insignificant file or whatever it is.
Steve, don't forget, that's a good point, and I totally agree, absolutely. But don't forget, what we're talking about here, we're talking about computer systems and software that lives depend on. So these are hypercritical, hyper redundant. These go above and beyond what your average OS is going to do. But point taken. That to me, that's a no brainer. Like that should have been solved. And I'm sure there are lots of OSs that do that, but the ones that I frequently use do not.
It does amaze me that no one at Microsoft, for example, has figured out that this is insane, that this is a serious end user issue that they should fix.
It's only been around for 15 years, though.
It's still the way it works. It still comes up. I'm amazed every time. Like, really? No one has figured out that this is a dumb idea.
It's happened to me a million times. Like, it's so frustrating.
Yeah. I think obviously some pieces of software are fantastic and, you know, I know it's really complicated, but, you know, being, using lots of different software all day, there's lots of programs and like really expensive high-end programs that have little end user issues that drive me crazy. And I do think that, you know, the software, there's some problem with how software is created. Like the engineers or whoever is designing the interface aren't really thinking in a sophisticated way about the experience of the end user. You know, don't get me started on my electronic medical record system at work. It is the worst piece of shit interface you could imagine.
How many people use that?
Mind boggling. It's a huge segment of the healthcare industry.
Oh, wow. Is it really?
Yes.
Oh, that's bad.
But Steve, that's funny. I experienced maybe something similar to what you're talking about, but from an end user perspective, I've gone to this doctor now, you know, every month for 5 or 6 months. And, I missed an appointment and I had to pay a fee. And every time I go to the doctor now for the past 3 times, they're saying, oh, you have to pay this fee. And I keep saying, I already paid it. Please take that off the record. I already paid this. I mean, how many times do I have to say or pay for something before you'll stop getting this pop-up saying, oh, by the way, Bob did not pay this late fee. Like, I did it. And that's minor compared to, I'm sure, what you're dealing with.
It's just, you know, it's obviously a very complicated piece of software. And it all works on the back end. It's just like the user interface is thoughtless. You know, it's like no one is managing the experience of the end user. And that's a huge difference. Just managing that experience versus not managing that experience. Huge difference. You can tell when it's been done and when it hasn't been done.
Yes.
You know, like I'm constantly working for the software instead of the software working for me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like I'm jumping through hoops and doing stuff to make it work rather than it making my life easier.
Yeah. Who's the machine here? Yeah. Who's the master?
Right. Who's working for whom? It's bad. It actually costs a lot of money because on average, this is not my statistic, this is what they even told us. On average, when the system gets used in an office, it drops productivity by 20%.
Oh, 20%
hit because
easily.
Yeah. Oh, that's huge.
That's huge. That something is wrong when that's happening.
They say this is a really old for internet development. You know, you go back, I think about 10 or 15 years, someone wrote a book called Don't Make Me Think.
Mm-hmm.
There were interfaces should never stop the user from moving forward.
Right.
Or not slow them down too much, right? You know, you just don't want the person to sit there and have to go, oh my God, where is this? How do I do that? That's so notorious for Microsoft products. You know, you ever use Excel or Word and you are looking for things quite often. You know, it's just not there. And then the other thing that blows my mind about Microsoft is then they will completely reinvent their interface.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, like I know
that
Outlook.
Does happen.
2005, I think it was. And now the latest version, like the ribbon version they have now. I mean, God, I'm in high school again.
We got frustrated with Skype. Remember, we've been using Skype for this show for the last 10 years. And it seems like every time they do a major upgrade, they make it worse because they're taking an interface, which has a certain intuitiveness about it. And you get used to it and then they change it. They don't make it better. They just change it. And oftentimes they make it less intuitive. And you're right. That's a perfect title. Don't Make Me Think. That's exactly right. Software should be designed so that you don't have to do a lot of mental work to navigate the software. Like basic things, like make it easy for me to find what it is I'm trying to interact with right now. Instead of burying it in all of this extra data that I don't need right now, and you should know I don't need it, because I just asked you for this one piece of data. Please just give me what I'm looking for and make it really obvious and easy for me to find. Don't make me hunt around my screen for the thing I just asked you for, you know?
It's really expensive to develop good interfaces. There's lots of techniques, like as an example, something called split testing, where they'll use, you'd like to think like two somewhat similar interfaces. You know, one difference could be the OK button is on the left versus on the right or whatever, right? They do things like that. And then they watch user experience. You know, they'll actually videotape people using it or interview people using it or just track what they're doing with like a heat map type of thing. They could see what people are doing and what they click and how long it takes them to do what they got to do. And then they make iterative advancements, till they literally get it to the point where
that's good.
It's as good as it's going to get.
You know what else is expensive? 20% drop in physician productivity. That's really expensive too.
Yeah, but that doesn't hit the people who are selling the software. The people that are selling the software just want to make the sale. You know what I mean? And it takes, like I said, it's a lot of work and it takes a lot of expertise to be really good at doing this type of thing.
I believe that. I don't think what I'm talking about, I mean, I think there is some low-hanging fruit that they're ignoring, but I understand that the really sophisticated stuff, like knowing where I'm looking on the screen and not making me hunt around for something, could be complicated to make it work well, but it's worth the investment when you have a piece of software this important and this widely used. There's no excuse, you know, for the level of crappy user interface that it currently has.
Yeah, the last thing you want is your doctor, like between every office visit, getting furious with his computer.
Oh, exactly. I'm doing a lot of mental work, you know, managing my patient, thinking about their complicated diagnoses and my treatment options. You don't want me using my brain to try to figure out a friggin' piece of software that I'm interacting with. That should be so simple it's not taking any attention away from practicing medicine, which is how the software is designed to function.
You just need a lot of minions, you know, like in Despicable Me. A bunch of those little guys to do all that kind of crap.
Yeah, but you really can't as a physician because there are certain things you just have to do yourself.
I really do think a lot of these problems are going to be solved when we get software that can operate. You know, it doesn't have to be artificial intelligence, but it'll have intelligence-like qualities.
Yeah.
Watson.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of it more on the fly. Like, wouldn't it be wonderful if you're using a piece of software and then you could just tell the software, I can't find this. Where is it? And it knows what you're talking about.
And then a little
about.
Paperclip shows up in the right lower right.
with a cartoon bubble that says,
Clippy,
hello.
Clippy.
Hello, enter username. I am Clippy.
All right. We've ranted enough for 1 week, I think. Let's move on. Right. Jay, tell us about military lasers.
Ooh, this sounds good, Jay. Hit me.
Sounds like sharks are coming too.
There's so much to say about this. This is really, you know, awesome. The advances that we've had in lasers. I had to pick and choose the things I wanted to tell you because I could talk for an hour just about the advancements. But everybody, right, guys, you know what a laser is, right? At least
light amplified sensor, something or other.
Light amplification through stimulated emission
of radiation.
Of radiation. Thank you.
There you go.
That's good. I remember Bob teaching me that when I was very young.
I remember forgetting it, yes.
And I think most of us even know what they are, mostly because of sci-fi, right? You know, lasers are just a huge part of science fiction. The acronym is light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. You know, laser emits optically amplified light, right? It's light that's focused down.
It's coherent. It's all the same wavelength. You're a regular white light bulb in your house has lots of different frequencies going in lots of different directions. Laser light's coherent light. So it's all in lockstep, incredibly powerful and focused. It doesn't diverge much at all.
And they're great.
Regular light.
Great for tormenting cats.
Yeah. Yes. And airplane pilots in their cockpits.
Well, no, you shouldn't do that.
Don't
do that.
They say that they're spatially coherent, you know, to give you a visual. It's the difference between, you know, throwing a bunch of a deck of cards in the air and they go everywhere versus throwing the cards in a row all in a tight line going in the same exact direction, right? Yep. So lasers go back to the 1960s. The first one was built by Theodore H. Meinemann at Hughes Laboratories. Billions of dollars have been spent. Billions and billions and billions of dollars have been spent globally to develop laser technology. You know, and this is a really good read. If you do a deep dive on the history of lasers, it's a really good read on just science and the progress of certain technologies, right? There's lots of different things that need to all come together in order for a laser to really be like the kind of laser where we're thinking like, you know, point this machine or this thing at that and blow it up type of laser. So a prototype weapon had been created by Boeing for the U.S. Army, and it's called the High Energy Laser Mobile Demonstrator. The HEL-MD, which I thought was cool.
Yeah.
So it's housed in a truck. Sits on the top of this big truck. What's cool about this particular laser is it's controlled by something that is very similar to a video game controller, which I thought was really cool. And the operator says it has a game-like feel when they use it, which I thought was really interesting. Now, many countries have tried to develop lasers over the years, and the recent extreme advancements that we made, a lot of them have come from or been leveraging the advancements in optical fibers. Now, optical fibers have been used quite a bit for other things like the internet and networking and, you know, sending information. And that technology was able to leverage previous laser technology. And now laser technology is leveraging advancements made with these optical fibers. So the United States spent a ton of money, as an example, back in the 80s to develop the anti-missile laser technology. You guys remember, what was it, Star Wars, right?
Yes.
During the Reagan era.
No, strategic defense.
They spent back then the equivalent of $2.4 billion, and the project flat out failed. You know, and I actually thought it, I didn't know it failed. I didn't realize that it was a complete failure until.
Oh, yeah, because they just didn't get anywhere near the power that they needed to take a missile out. Nowhere near it.
Plus, right. A lot of people didn't like the Star Wars moniker. It was really called SDI, remember? Strategic Defense Initiative. Yeah.
Yep. Right, right, yeah.
So we just gear right, Steve. We couldn't power it. The lasers were not effective enough. They couldn't target the way they needed to. Just the overall different fields of technology were just not there to make it happen. Now, I asked the question, like, what do we want a laser to actually do? We're not really like asking a laser to do something extraordinary. We're basically saying focus a ton of energy on this particular spot, heat it up, and damage it. That's pretty much what we want the laser to do.
Sure.
So if
a weapon, yes.
But it turns out that's really hard, Charlie, right? That's a hard thing to do.
Especially in an atmosphere.
Right, Bob, that's a good point. The atmosphere wreaks havoc on lasers. The particulate in the atmosphere, there's atmospheric turbulence, which is, you know, the movement of the air, like heat or cold air moving up or down, distort the laser, and it basically scatters the laser and it decentralizes the light beam and it makes it less powerful. It scatters the light, making less photons hit the target. So they've come up with ways to counteract that, Bob. I'm happy you brought that up. They came up with a way with mirrors to actually distort the laser, so when it does get redistorted by the atmosphere, it aligns itself.
Right.
Oh, cool.
Kind of like adaptive optics that take into account the atmosphere above them in order to change the shape of the primary mirrors so that it could cancel out the distortion. That's awesome. That's really cool.
And because of adaptive optics, back in 2010, they were able, I think, for the first time, to successfully blow up a missile in flight with a laser beam. So Boeing's HEL-MD prototype uses a commercial 10-kilowatt fiber laser, and that's not really considered to be an enormously powerful laser, particularly when they thought back in the 80s that we would need an order of magnitude more laser power in order to be effective. But what's really cool is this laser gets its power just from the vehicle it's mounted on. Now, I'll give it to you. It's like the size of like a fire truck. It's a pretty damn big vehicle. It's using the vehicle's engine, and it's using another power source inside the truck. It has like generators on the truck and all that. But the cool thing is that they said it uses such an incredibly small amount of fuel. It only costs about $10 per shot.
Whoa, that's impressive.
A $10 laser beam being focused on a missile long enough to heat it up at the right spot to do enough damage to disable $100,000, $500,000, $1 million missile. It's like
more than that.
Peanuts, right? It's peanuts.
Oh my God.
you know, like I said, the tracking system technology wasn't there. And now that we have, you know, we have advanced computerized aiming, the Hellmed can operate by itself. It can actually, you know, do its own targeting. It'll know what to look
for.
Wait.
You got to make sure it's not a friendly, right?
Wait, computerized aiming? You mean like all those science fiction ships don't use when they try to hit
our
hero?
Bob, right? Exactly. You know, the thing I hate about Star Wars, like, I never say that, but one of the things that does bother me from time to time is, like, you know, Han Solo's getting shot at by, you know, a couple of dozen stormtroopers. You know, not one of them hits. I mean, what are these guys, like, drunk? Like, what's up with these stormtroopers?
They are. They're like the worst shots in the galaxy.
They're supposed to be the shock troops. They're supposed to be the tough guys.
Well, they're clumsy weapons.
Well, they're supposed to be very accurate, according to Ben Kenobi.
All right, so guys,
points too accurate for
the most. The most important thing I want to tell you, which leads me to something fun that I prepared for you, is one funny thing is that this laser that's mounted on this vehicle, the Hel-MD laser, is invisible and silent.
Yeah, I kind of figured that laser technology one day, if we ever got into a working weapon, is not going to be some kind of particle beam that you can see like in the movie. It's going to be traveling.
Yeah. How
speed
disappointing!
Of light,
and, how disappointing!
And it doesn't go choo 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 choo.
The operators sometimes don't even know that the laser had done anything. They
God!
Right. So guess what the developers said? They said that they're going to add Star Trek and Star Wars laser sounds to overlay
that,
when the laser fires.
That made my week.
Wow.
That just made my week.
They have to use science and technology to dumb it down for our stupid human senses,
that's
basically.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Well, that's good. It's a feedback that everyone understands that tells you the laser fired. That makes perfect sense.
We can't have a computer tell us? I mean,
right, so guys,
why? It's just pew, they're fired. You know,
I get that it's cool and everything. It's kind of
it's
satisfying.
Also effective, though. It's also
satisfying.
I love it.
But, all right, so okay. I thought that I would prepare a few classic sci-fi sounds for you. Don't scream out the answers. Let me play it and then let the audience guess. Then you could say what you think it is. So here's the first one.
Oh, that's a class whatever phaser, handheld phaser for Star Trek original series.
That was easy.
Well, excuse me, Bob. Just, you know, trying to. All right, what's
I like
one?
Starting with these.
Of course, it's easy for us, Jay. Any Star
what's
Trek fan.
One? What was that?
Well, is it from the Star Wars universe?
Yeah, I think it was Star Wars. One of the blasters from Star Wars.
Is it a Stormtrooper one or is it?
Good job.
Han
good
Solo's?
Job, Evan.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, now my really hard one, because I knew you idiots, and I wasn't gonna give you one without giving you a hard one.
I know what that is. That's James Bond.
Oh my God, Bob, that's great.
Wow. Goldfinger. Come
yeah,
on.
To
so
help
distinctive.
You to help you remember, here's the most important piece of dialogue in that scene.
Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Yeah, it's a classic line. I expect you to die.
The big question is, when will we have a power supply potent enough to have an effective handheld laser? That's
where we're away from that.
Oh, wow.
We're still working on the truck-based lasers. You know, handheld lasers, long way away.
I agree. But remember, it doesn't need to be as powerful. I mean, to make it lethal for a person is a lot less than lethal for a missile. But still, even if it had a backpack, it would still be cool. You know, even if it was something heavy, but you could still carry it, that would be cool. But one day.
Yeah, it's no different than running around with a flamethrower on your back.
Lasers were developed in the 60s, 1960, and now we're 55 years later. I mean, it's a long time, man. It's a long time.
Lasers have been one of the best, you know, coolest inventions of all time. Because when they first created it, nobody could have predicted all the applications that lasers have, not just as weapons. Obviously, you have them in your damn DVD players and a million other places. It's just incredible how versatile that is.
All right, guys, do you remember a couple years ago we talked about a sting operation where a scientist published over 300 crappy
300
articles in the open source journals, and over half of them published the crappy article without even doing any peer review. That was John Bohannon. Well, he's done it again. He's done another science publication sting
Magoo.
Oh, operation.
Boy. I love it. Guerrilla, what do we call it? Guerrilla publishing.
Okay.
Or whatever. We got to come up with a term for it.
All right. So this time he was going after nutrition studies. What he did was, and he was collaborating with others on this, he recruited 16 volunteers. One dropped out, so we had a remaining 15 people. That's a teeny tiny study.
Yes.
And he divided them into three groups. One, he fed a low-carb diet for 3 weeks. The second, he fed a low-carb diet plus a daily chocolate for 3 weeks. And then the third was the no-change control, just eat whatever you were eating. And then he looked at a bunch of different variables. And it turns out that the group that had the low-carb diet plus the chocolate lost 10% more weight than the group with just the low-carb diet over those 3 weeks.
Must have been the chocolate.
So then he wrote a paper concluding that chocolate helps you lose weight. You know, eating a chocolate a day is associated with weight loss.
Okay.
He didn't get it published in a high impact, you know, prestigious journal, but he got it published in a peer reviewed journal. And then he sent out a press release and a whole bunch of news outlets printed it as chocolate helps you lose weight. This is an example of p-hacking. Have I said that term on the show before? Have you guys heard p-hacking?
Yeah.
I remember p-zombies.
I know I know you've blogged about it a lot, but I think we've mentioned it on the show. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's basically massaging the numbers to get to statistical significance. So he was deliberately doing that. So one of the ways you could do that is by looking at a lot of different outcomes and then picking the one that is significant, right? If you're using a 0.05 p-value, that means, you know, essentially the chance of the data being what it is, if the null hypothesis is true, is about 5%. So that means if you have 20 outcomes, by chance, at least one should be reach 0.05 statistical significance. So that's an easy way to cheat. Just look at a whole bunch of things and then print the one, publish the one that is, that reached significance. You could also, you know, keep collecting data until you get to that significance. You could try different kinds of tests to see which one, which, you know, which kind of statistical analysis gives you the answer you're looking for. You could
small sample size.
Yeah. Small sample size tends to magnify any quirky outliers. Yeah. So he deliberately did p-hacking, published a terrible study with a completely unsupportable. I mean, the data does not support that conclusion at all. And yet the media bit. A lot of outlets published it without any skepticism, without anything, just chocolate helps you lose weight. And then he did the big reveal. You know, wrote the paper with his colleagues explaining exactly what they did. Just, it's good. It's a good, you know, public demonstration of the pitfalls and perils of p-hacking. A good teaching moment, you know, for the media as well as for anyone interested in interpreting scientific studies. You have to understand how false positives can be manufactured out of any data and keep out for, because we always get that. Like, we get this as skeptics. Oh, what do you say about this study? This guy showed that whatever ESP is real or astrology is real. It's like, yeah, well, one study by one researcher, you know, with these methods and, you know, these sort of barely statistically significant results or razor thin effect sizes. I mean, this is just not compelling. And this is why, because who knows what kind of p-hacking they were doing behind the scenes. We only get interested when your results are replicated multiple times, you know, independent replication where the methods were held constant. So you can't p-hack. And
it's such a big, important part of the scientific method.
Yeah.
It can't be understated.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, then it sounds like you're denying, you know, it's like, oh, you're not accepting the research. Like, no, it's just, you have absolutely no idea where the real threshold needs to be. And now you're combining one crappy study that hasn't been replicated with an almost impossible hypothesis, you know? So what's more likely, that there was a little p-hacking going on here, or we have to rewrite the physics textbooks?
Yeah, I even read a review of what he did, a negative review, and this person was like upset that he did this. The person was like, well, I mean, a lot of people already know the state of this industry. Because of that, it doesn't really warrant somebody tricking everyone.
Apparently it does. And,
yeah, right. I mean,
nonsense.
I disagree. I think it shows it puts these methods in a wonderful light and really shows you, you know, what can be done. And I like how he actually did the experiment. He really went through it. He really had people, and the people that were writing about it that actually talked to him by email. None of these people that write about this all the time, none of them said, well, wait, how big? I didn't notice how big your sample size was. How many people were in there? They didn't even ask it. I think Shape Magazine wrote an article about it. And then I think it was, Men's Fitness. Did an interview Well, they did an interview with him, and he said it was the same kind of like superficial, non-penetrating questions, and that it was slated for the magazine in the fall. So they probably dodged a bullet.
Yeah.
Because now, of course, they're not going to do it. But all these, you know, and everybody, nobody was asking the right questions. He said
that, and that was the point of the stunt. And obviously, it was needed because it worked. I wrote about another sort of meta science topic I wanted to mention as well. So I keep a list of all the ways in which science can be biased and manipulated, et cetera, because these are things you need to avoid and you need to be aware of when you're evaluating studies. And this is a new one that a colleague brought up to me, and I looked into it. It's called citation bias. You guys ever probably never heard of that? Yeah. So this is interesting. So what a few now papers have demonstrated is that there are multiple ways in which scientists can either deliberately or probably mostly inadvertently distort the impression about what the scientific evidence says by biasing how they reference the research. So when one scientific paper references another, that's called a citation. And the number of citations that a paper gets is its impact factor, and the number of the impact factor of the articles in a journal affects the impact factor of that journal. So that's the coin of the realm, right? That's what journals and papers want. They want to get a lot of citations. It's like likes on Facebook, right? But of course, you have any kind of system like that and it can be manipulated. What happens sometimes is, I think sometimes the innocent result of confirmation bias, right? If you're writing a paper or you're doing a study and you're looking for published studies that support a premise in your research, you're kind of looking for positive studies. And then you're going to cite those studies to support a premise that you're then going to build on for your research. And then therefore, there's a bias towards citing positive studies. But that can get out of hand. That could create a completely false narrative about what the data shows. So what the article that really first talks about citation bias, what they did was they looked at a very specific scientific question, and then they looked at all the studies that attempt to answer that question. And in fact, the data was mostly negative. There was some positive studies, some negative studies, but on the whole, the data is probably negative. But what they found was that the positive studies had hundreds of citations. The negative studies had almost none. It was this massive bias. The papers that get cited more often, they're easier to find. They're you know what I mean? They're going to be more prominent, and it sort of feeds on itself. So it's like crowdsourcing, and in a way, and it is the kind of thing that magnifies itself. They also pointed out other related phenomena, like they have citation diversion, which we've talked about without using that term, where you cite a paper that doesn't support the point you're citing it for. You know, it shows something other than what you're saying it shows. So, you know, pseudoscientists do all the time. They have like lists of references for the claims that they're making and hoping that no one's going to actually click through to the references. Cause if you do, you'll see that they don't support the point they're making. Sometimes they in fact directly contradict it, but they're just looking to cite a lot of studies to seem sciencey, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, that happens in the, among mainstream scientists too. They might cite a paper and not interpret it properly. So you have to go back to the original research. There's citation amplification, where you can get out of one set of data, you can get a lot of studies and then do reviews and do analysis and do meta-analysis. And you can generate a lot of papers and dominate the literature by attracting a lot of citations, even though you're building off of maybe a small set of data. Perhaps that's contradicted by a larger set of negative data that's not getting cited. So anyway, it's one more thing. It's one more potential bias in the way science is reported and evaluated that can create a false narrative that isn't supported by the data. And it supports the skeptical rule of thumb is always track back to the original sources and look at the actual data and decide what the data is saying, not what people are saying the data is saying, but what is the data saying. Of course, that's hard for non-scientists to do, especially about highly technical questions. And you're kind of dependent upon a consensus of systematic reviews and a consensus of scientific opinion. But even it's tricky. It's tricky to do that and get it right. I do think eventually, you know, it just takes one skeptical scientist to go, you know what? The data here doesn't support what you're saying. Here's the data. It's the data is the data. And that tends, in my experience, that does tend to then hold sway. But people can perpetuate a false narrative for a long time in literature just by cherry picking, essentially. This is just a formalized way of cherry picking the data that you wish, the data that you want. Scary. Mm. All right, Evan, apparently our estimates about the number of species that exist in the world may be off.
Yeah. Not sure we've ever really had a good handle on it, though, to begin with.
Yeah.
So how many species do you think there are?
Three.
The correct answer is as many as the Ark could hold.
Right.
There have been many, many calculations made over the past, decades. I mean, we're going back six decades worth of data. There are estimates as low as 500,000. And there's estimates as high as 100 million. That's a huge, huge stretch there. And we're having trouble sort of with the models of trying to determine how to apply them so we can get a better narrowing of how many species we really think there are.
Yeah, because we haven't like actually counted them all. Yeah. We're estimating the number of species, extrapolating from the ones that we know about definitively.
And this is true up to very, very recent times. In fact, I looked at a issue of Scientific American from 2014 where they reported about, where they reported on a paper that was published in Trends in Ecology and Evolution, which stated that we demonstrate that after more than six decades, estimates of global species richness have failed to converge, remain highly uncertain, and in many cases are logically inconsistent. Convergence in these estimates could be accelerated by adaptive learning methods where the estimation of uncertainty is prioritized and used to guide future research. Basically, it's a fancy way of saying we have no freaking idea. Mm-hmm. However, a more recent study has maybe helped, well, narrow it down a little bit so that we can get at least a little bit of a better idea on how many species there are. This was a paper published by the U.S.-based journal called Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, also known as PNAS, I think we've referred to before on the show. And it was Professor Nigel Stork of the Griffiths Environmental Futures Research Institute. He revealed findings that narrow the global species estimates for beetles, insects, and terrestrial arthropods. And from those estimates, we're kind of able to get a little better figure of how many species overall there are. Professor Stork said that by narrowing down how many species exist within the largest group, which are the insects and other arthropods, we're now in a position to try to improve estimates for all species, including plants, fungi, and vertebrates. Now, here's what we've got. We've got about 25% of all species that have been described on the planet are beetles.
Isn't that amazing?
That is one of the
and
best.
An inordinate fondness for beetles.
Yes. Yeah. Somebody had to say it, yes.
Why is that?
Definitely.
It's this very successful group. I mean, there's no other way
they
to say
rock.
It. Just really versatile, successful. And they're small. Really, I think they're small helps, you know. You're not going to get that many species of large mammals.
And then you combine beetles with all the other insects that are out there, and you've got about now half of the species on the Earth, or at least the ones that are described.
The ones that are described, yeah. We need to be clear about that.
Right. Yes, the ones that are described. So Professor Stork and his colleagues focused on asking how many species of beetles and insects there actually are, and in the process to apply this new method of estimating the overall numbers of species, which means that they looked at larger species of British beetles from a collection that are being held at the Natural History Museum. That's the British Natural History Museum, which has an extensive worldwide collection of beetles. And they're able to actually measure the body size or the mean body size with the changing body sizes of these British beetles. What they're able to reveal is that roughly 10% of the world's beetles have been named and described. And from that, they can extrapolate that we're looking at probably about 1.5 million species of beetles and 8.6 million species of terrestrial arthropods, which is way down from the prior ranges, which included, well, here, how about some of these for ranges? Like in the 1980s,
when they had only two methods of estimating species. The beetles had a mean of 17.5 million species, the range being 4.9 million to 40.7 million
what?
Species of beetles. That's your range.
Oh my God.
Because they, because the estimating models they had were, you know, they really only had these two methods and it had to allow for these huge, huge plus or minus figures.
Yeah.
And check this out. For the terrestrial arthropods, the mean was 38.6 million. The range was 7 million to 80 million.
Oh my God.
Talk about opening the floodgates. I mean, that's.
So where are all these beetles?
Well, that's just it, is that we don't know, Jay. But with the new methods that they're using for actually measuring the body size of the beetles, they're able to now narrow it down a little bit more. Now the range is about 1 million species to 2.1 million, a much more
that's reasonable.
Manageable.
And because they hammered a better way to measure their body size, they were able to do that?
That's right. That's right. They compared the mean body size with the changing body sizes of British beetles throughout the time and using these specimens at the British Natural History Museum to do that. And their extrapolations and their calculations helped narrow this down.
So, Ev, now they know that these beetles are British. Why? Because of their teeth?
Yes, because of their teeth and because of the amount of number one hits they had over their careers.
And how many best acting Oscars they have, right?
Right. They're Shakespearean beetles, Bob. Classically trained.
Oh, my God. It's awesome.
Like, why do we need to know this? Is this important information in any science circles out there?
It is, Jay. What it allows, well, if you speak to the experts, and I did read up on what some of the experts had to say. For example, Julian Cayley, who's a researcher at the Australian Institute of Marine Science, and he was one of the main authors of the paper. He says what it does is it gives us an indication of what we actually know about these really important ecosystems around the world and how they function. Without baseline knowledge of how many species there are out there, you can't know what you're managing. You really need a baseline. So scientists who are working to protect or restore ecosystems, this information is important. Otherwise, they don't know if they're having an impact or not with regards to species saved and other tracks of work that they're doing.
Cool. Okay, that's awesome.
Hey, you know what we haven't had in a while?
What?
Quickie with Bob.
Thank you, Steve. This is your Quickie with Bob. This is a good one. They're all good. So after at least three decades, scientists may finally have a decent handle on the mystery of where proton spin comes from.
Finally.
Now, this type of particle spin is essentially a form of angular momentum analogous to a spinning top. But keep in mind, like all analogies, especially quantum mechanical ones, this is not 100% accurate, of course. So now it was assumed as a no-brainer that the spin of a proton is derived from the spin of its constituent particles. Makes perfect sense, right? In this case, that means that the spins of the three quarks that make up protons determine the proton spin. I mean, totally reasonable. But studies that were done years ago confirmed that the quarks account for only 30% of the total proton spin. So where the hell does the rest of that spin come from? And this has been dubbed the proton spin crisis.
Love crisis.
I love science.
Oh my gosh, what are we going
to
do?
Like the ultraviolet crisis, which is...
Is it time to panic?
Ultraviolet catastrophe.
Oh, you're right. That wasn't a crisis. It was a catastrophe, even worse. But that one, of course, led to some amazing things. So look that one up.
How did we ever survive? I don't know.
I know. So now recent results from new experiments have now implicated gluon spin for 40% of proton spin. Now, gluons are the force particles exchanged between quarks and are responsible for the color force and ultimately the strong force, the strongest force in nature. So it's these little force particles that are also contributing spin. But of course, if you do your math, that now leaves only 30% of the proton spin that's unaccounted for, which is a lot better than 70%.
That part comes from God.
Yes, right. So there's still a little bit of a mystery of 30%, which is a lot better than 70%, but hopefully they will now downgrade the proton spin crisis to perhaps the proton spin concern, or maybe even the proton spin mild unease.
I think it should be the proton spin kerfuffle.
Kerfuffle. That's not bad either. So that's it, guys. This was your quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Bob, thanks. Do those terms actually mean anything, though?
What's that?
Quark and
no. I mean, like, does when they call something like a problem or an issue or whatever, does it mean anything?
Well, sure. I mean, proton spin crisis, that was a huge problem.
They don't have an operational definition, Jay, if that's what you're asking.
Thank you, Steve.
Oh, an op. No.
Oh, an op def.
Yeah. No op def.
No op def.
All right, guys, before we move on to Who's That Noisy, I have a quick announcement myself. This is a bit of sad news.
Do
you guys ever meet Wally Sampson, Dr. Wallace Sampson?
Of course.
Bob, I know you did.
He wrote for Science-Based Medicine.
Yes, he was one of the original authors of Science-Based Medicine. He was the editor of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine, and he has been fighting health fraud for decades. I mean, this guy had been doing this for a long time. So he did pass away on May 25th. He was 85. He had a good run.
Can't argue with
85. But of course we're all very, very sad to lose him. He hasn't been well for a little while, and he, you know, retired from blogging for Science-Based Medicine a few years ago. So we knew that he was at the end of his career, and, you know, he had some health issues. So it didn't come as a shock, but it's very sad, you know, obviously to lose one of the giants of the science-based medicine crowd. I mean, the thing that was really amazing about him is how nurturing he was. I mean, we all sort of had the same story to tell when I was a young nobody, right? You know, we were running the New England Skeptical Society, but nobody knew who the hell I was. He invited me to conferences to speak and invited me to be an assistant editor on his journal. And, you know, he recognized that, you know, I was a skeptical physician who was interested in this and totally nurtured me along. It's possible that science-based medicine would not exist, you know, if it weren't for, you know, his mentorship and his nurturing early on in my career.
Oh, wow.
And like Harriet Hall said the same thing. So he took it upon himself to be a mentor to all of the people who are like now running science-based medicine. So, really a giant. Bob, I think he is a forgotten superhero of skepticism. Mm. I think simply because he was retiring right when the real big social media push was coming, you know, just he was laboring away doing what I'm doing, but he was doing it without the kind of exposure that you get from social media, but, definitely deserves to be remembered. And of course, he'll always have a place of honor on the science-based medicine website. And I wanted to make sure that everyone knew about him.
Another library is lost.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, but thank goodness we still have his writings to go back and refer to, because he did a real excellent job in his blog post. I enjoyed reading.
Yeah. No, great body of work. Absolutely. All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
Last week, I played something very eerie. I'm going to play it again. Tell me, guys, what you think.
Mr. Kerlak, we're all responsible. Educators, clinicians, social organizations, conserving and protecting.
What is that?
That's creepy as shit. That's the kind of thing. If you play that softly, like in someone's room when they're going to sleep, they would have a coronary.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
All right, so I figured something out. All right, so I'm going to tell you
what it is. That's a good prank.
I'm going to tell you what it is, and then I'm going to tell you.
Sleep over at Steve's.
I'll tell you exactly what it should be. Okay, ready? So that was a talking piano.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Pianos don't talk.
And that was correctly guessed first by Daniel Jenkins. Daniel Jenkins! So, a Austrian composer, Peter Ablinger, used a Fourier transform algorithm to turn human speech into musical notes, which he then programmed into a robot to play on a real piano keyboard. Now, guys, isn't this exactly the way that ghosts would communicate with us?
Yeah, that would be a great horror movie where the ghost is playing the piano to talk. Oh, that is a cool idea.
Thank you. Somebody needs to do that, needs to weave that right into a ghost story.
Jay, you can't just like go to a normal piano and replicate that, though. You need it's special.
If you're a ghost, No, Bob, it really isn't. If you, you know, not that I don't think that this would be easy under any stretch of the imagination, but if you trained like five people to get on a piano and do what this, what the robot hands are doing, it's possible that people could probably play something like this.
Or it could also be an alien, or it could be an AI. I mean, there's different, anything that could theoretically get access to a player piano or something, or even electronic piano. And use it as a surrogate, you know, way of generating human speech.
Sure.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
All right. So for this week's Noisy, I want you to tell me who this is.
Over here. Up there, I saw a UFO, and it went down the river.
Who is that?
Huh. Harry Potter.
Eric Idle.
Guess who that person is. Email me at WTN. At theskepticsguide.org. And hurry up. I got a ton of entries from last week. Tons of you guessed the piano thing. It was really cool, actually. A lot of people were writing in like, hey, I think it's a piano. And they were trying to, you know, puzzle it out how it was done.
Yeah.
A few people knew exactly what it was. But yeah, it was a fun Noisy. Please email me.
So we got a couple of quick emails. These are follow-ups to topics that we covered on previous episodes. Some good feedback I want to talk about. The first one comes from Max right here in Hartford. Right around the corner. And Max writes, in a recent science or fiction, Steve included a news item suggesting that about 20% of college females had been victims of rape or some other form of sexual assault. The rogues were almost incredulous upon hearing such a high figure, as was I, not just because it seemed incredibly high, but because late last year I'd read an article reporting that the number was around 0.61% of college females. The article claimed to have gotten this figure from a recent DOJ report on sexual assaults. I was able to dig around for the report, which can be found in the following link from the Bureau of Justice Statistics website. Honestly, I'm not even sure what to believe anymore regarding this topic, but I trust the SGU more than I do most media outlets, so if you say the 20% figure is the more accurate figure, then I'll be more inclined to dismiss the DOJ's report. If not, then it seems you guys are due for a correction. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you, Max. That's a good question. We got a number of questions about that. Not as many as I was expecting, actually. Whenever, you know, we touch on a big topic, like for science or fiction, and I do a quick treatment of it, you know, it's hard to cover this whole issue in the very few minutes we have for a science or fiction wrap up. But that's why I'm taking a second bite at it now to give a little bit more of the background. So I tried to add enough caveats into my original discussion to make sure it was understood that that was one survey about, you know, an upstate New York university saying that 18.9% of the women interviewed said that in their freshman year, they were the victim of either a rape or an attempted rape. That's a high figure, and it was definitely surprising. This issue has been, I've been paying attention to this issue for a while and trying to really wrap my head around these statistics. I think the bottom line is that we really don't know what the number is. There, we don't have sufficient data to really nail down what the actual figure is. So here's what we do have, right? We have a couple of big surveys. From two large universities, one in the Midwest, one in the South. This was the survey that has been widely reported. It was referenced by Vice President Biden in a speech. This is the 1 in 5 figure that has, become sort of the go-to for people saying that rape on college campuses is a huge problem. So, the problem with those surveys, they showed about 20%, right? About 1 in 5. The problem with those surveys is that it was self-selective. It was a web-based survey. And so people could, you know, would choose to give the survey. So that means it's self-selective. And the reporting rate was fairly low, which means that self-selection bias can have a huge impact on the actual numbers. So it's hard to use that as a single source for saying this is what the number is. Max referred to the Department of Justice statistics, and yes, that was a different kind of survey that showed their number was 6.1 per 1,000. By the way, it was 7.6 per 1,000 for women who were not students. So the risk of being the victim of sexual assault was actually higher if you were not in college at the same age. But in any case, Now, that's probably an underestimate for a number of reasons. One is that this was a household survey. So it's quite possible that, you know, they would call somebody up and then that person would give the responses for the household. So they may have been talking to a parent saying, it was anyone in your household been the victim of rape? And if their child didn't disclose that to them, they wouldn't know, you know, so that's been criticized as likely being an underestimate of the actual number. So we have some methods, which probably underestimate the number, showing this, you know, 0.6%. Other surveys, which are probably overestimating the number. Again, this is like rapes and attempted rapes or sexual assault. It kind of depends on exactly how you ask the question, which is true of all surveys. But, you know, we're getting this 18-19%, you know, percent at the high end. One of the surveys that I think has the best methodology, actually my wife knew about this because this is what she does for a living, is this kind of stuff. She works in a college counseling office, but she said, oh, the best statistics come from the National College Health Assessment. And their statistics, let me just read you what they report. So for females reporting that they were the victims of sexual touching without their consent, 9.7%, sexual penetration attempt without their consent, 4.3%, and sexual penetration without their consent, 2.7%. So those are kind of in the middle, which is interesting. So we have data ranging from, you know, a little bit less than 1% to almost 20%, and then some kind in the middle, you know, if you take all that together, it's around 10% or so. That's what we have. And we don't have any rock solid surveys that have really high numbers of reporting with really good methodology. And I think the best methods of all those studies is probably the National College Health Assessment one, with that was sort of in the middle. I do think that it'd be a good idea to try to find a way of compensating for the self-reporting and the under-reporting to try to get the estimates a little bit closer. The other advantage to the health assessment is that it's all, many colleges participate in this, whereas the two surveys where one was at two colleges and the one that we were reporting on Science or Fiction was one college. So it's hard to extrapolate to all colleges or all universities. You know, we don't know how size plays a role, the size of the university or the part of the country or whatever. I mean, it's just hard to extrapolate from that. It's not necessarily generalizable. But the point that we made when we were talking about this is even if it's an overestimate by an order of magnitude, it's still a huge problem. I mean, I don't think that debate over, yeah, what the actual number is. I mean, it's important. Do the science. Let's figure out what the actual numbers are. Let's figure out, you know, have the best data we can. But I don't think that the debate about what the actual number is should distract from the fact that whatever anywhere in that range is too high. You know what I mean? And I think that it's still a problem. I think, you know, we shouldn't keep us from focusing on how are we going to make campuses safer? And just in society in general, how are we going to, you know, make it so that this is much less common? I think that's the more important thing. While we collect the data, you know, do that too, but let's not make that a distraction. Jay, the next one is about the item that you talked about, charities. And we got a few people making the same point. So let me just read this. One comes from Michael, and he writes, regarding your recent piece on charities with high overhead costs and low transparency, you may be interested in following this piece up with some information about why it's not just the overhead costs and transparency that can be problems in charities, but also their effectiveness. Some charities projects actually have negative impacts on communities, and some charities are hundreds or even thousands of times more effective than others. I think this is an important addition, and SGU is a great platform to share it. The work of Peter Singer and organizations such as GiveWell and The Life You Can Save are good places to start, and I'm also happy to provide some more information and ideas being involved in this space myself. So that was pretty typical of the feedback we got. There were some people were saying that we were unfair to focus on efficiency and that some charities may have a very high effectiveness, even though their efficiency is 10% or whatever is lowish. Some people thought it was unfair that we said that using professional fundraisers was an unfair red flag for a questionable charity, because legitimate charities might use professional fundraisers also. Jay, you can tell me what your take on this was, but you know, my take was that, yeah, it's a really good point. Effectiveness is another way to look at how valuable a charity is overall. Efficiency and effectiveness, I think, are two complementary ways of measuring that. I don't think, though, I wasn't convinced by the argument that a reasonable effectiveness trumps a really low efficiency. If 10 cents on my donated dollar is going to the thing that I think it's going to, even if they're being effective with that 10 cents, it still bothers me that there's a 90% inefficiency built into the system. I don't think that effectiveness completely trumps efficiency. I think the two are complementary. You have to consider both, you know? And I just don't see how there's any excuse for an efficiency that's that low.
Yeah, but it seems like a no-brainer. 10% is a joke. I don't care how good they are with that 10%.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, why even bother?
Well, I mean, they could be doing good work, but I mean, I think that's not an excuse to accept a really low efficiency. You have to work on that problem too. And if it's the professional fundraisers that are causing the inefficiency, that's a problem. You know, I don't think, that should just be accepted, you know, that only 10 or 20% or whatever is going to the thing that your people are donating to. And
at least not without proper disclosure.
Yeah. I mean, you got to have transparency.
You really do.
And the thing is, they don't want to do that because who the hell's going to donate? 10 cents on your dollar goes to, you know, who's going to donate to the charity who discloses that up front?
What the hell, though? I mean, you're otherwise, in a sense, being lied to in a certain context.
So, what do you think about the idea that they're not legally allowed to call themselves a charity unless they hit a certain percentage benchmark?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. Or, you know, or have tax exempt status, you know? You shouldn't have tax exempt status unless a certain percentage of the money you're collecting is going to the charity that you say it's supposed to go to. Anyway, thanks. That definitely added a needed dimension to the discussion. Also, a few people mentioned, I think this got edited out because I remember bringing this up. I didn't make the edit. There is a good resource called the Charity Navigator. So I think it's just charitynavigator.com. You go there and it'll rank a charity for you. So if you want to check out a charity to know what its efficiency and effectiveness and transparency is, you could go there and it will tell you about it before you donate any significant amount of money. All right, guys. Hey, before we go on to science or fiction, we have to talk about the amazing meeting. It's coming up quick. It's going to be It's going to be here really quick. You guys
are I'm so excited.
Weeks.
But I'm excited to be right on the strip again because I've literally not gone to the strip in years. So it'd be nice, you know, with the little free time that we do have to pop over to this hotel or that hotel. So it's going to be cool.
One of the great things about this coming, Tam, and I think for people who have been to the website, which is amazingmeeting.com, is that we're going to see quite a tribute to the one and only James Randi, and there's going to be a lot of discussion about his body of work throughout his life and sort of a focus and celebration on all that he has done and frankly deserved, because he's one of the most selfless people I've ever met in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yep, George Traub is going to be emceeing again. He's an awesome MC. I can't wait to see what he comes up with for his intro to Tam this year. We might be helping him with that. We'll see. And a great speaker list. Hey, Zach Wienersmith is going to be here. He's the creator of the Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. I've never met him.
Cool. No, wow. I haven't either. Looking forward to it.
So, of course, we'll be doing our performance from the stage. We'll be doing our dinner. Sign up for the Friday night SGU dinner, which will include an auction and a show. And we'll be available at our tables. And, you know, we always try to make a lot of time to talk with and meet with our listeners while we're there. It's a great, great time to interface with them. So if you haven't been to an amazing meeting, go. If you have been to an amazing meeting, you don't need us to tell you that. You know how awesome they are. I'm sure you want to go again. So check out amazingmeeting.com, and we hope to see a lot of you there. Definitely come up to us and say hi. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Jay, you were a solo winner last week.
That's right. Right? Thank you. Yes,
and
it was.
I swept you the week before. I swept everybody.
Sure.
So I think that means that Bob and Evan lost 2 weeks in a row, at least.
Is that what that means?
Yeah. If I got my, no, I had my math.
I lost count.
Yeah. Bob, I think you need to turn this ship around, Bob. Got to get your numbers back on track for this year.
Well, I mean, I think I'm still in the lead, but I'm not. I don't have a commanding lead that I deserve, so it's early. It's early in the year.
It's not even halfway done yet. All right, here we go. No theme this week. Item number one, a new study finds that an impaired ability to identify odors is associated with a significant increase in the risk of death over a four-year follow-up. Item number two, researchers find that higher socioeconomic status correlates with a significantly increased breadth of taste in music. And item number three, a new study changes the estimate for the evolution of eukaryotes from a maximum of 2.8 billion years ago to 1.5 billion years ago, 1.3 billion years later than previously thought. Bob, I think it's your turn to go first.
All right, so an impaired ability to identify odors is associated with a significant increase in risk. That's really concerning because I often do not smell things that other people do. Just today, someone said, "Bob, your dog smells," and I did not notice. So that's making me a little worried. So I hope that's the fiction. So if you're richer, there's a correlation between that and an increased breadth of taste in music. Oh, geez. The hell? I mean, I can make an argument either way. I mean, there's nothing here that's really making me lean one way or the other. That's not a good sign. And let's look at the last one. Let's see. Eukaryotic life evolving started not 2.8 billion years ago, but 1.5. Huge, huge difference. That just goes against a lot of this kind of news I've come across over the years, because usually we're always expanding, increasing, and pushing things farther back into history. And this is the first time that I can think of over the top of my head that not only are we going in the other direction, but by a huge chunk, 1.5 billion. So what does that mean? That they had evidence of eukaryotic life evolving 2.8 billion years ago, and then it was discredited. So they're like, oh, okay, that's no longer valid. We need to go to the next latest one, which is 1.5 billion years ago. That strikes me as maybe not as likely. It's the only one that's really giving me pause. So I'll say that the eukaryote one is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
An impaired ability to identify odors associated with an increase in the risk of death over a four-year follow-up. It's correlation. I wouldn't be surprised that the study found that, actually. Don't know that they necessarily know exactly why. It doesn't really matter. I mean, really just kind of lining up the numbers. So I think that one's right. The next one, higher socioeconomic status correlates with a significantly increased breadth of taste in music. That's sort of the common sense kind of thing. Like, of course, because, you know, they have access to buy more music or have exposure to more music, music lessons, music classes, and so forth. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if they find out that this one actually finds out not being true, because I think that probably increased all across all socioeconomic factors, higher, middle, and lower. But the last one, 2.8 billion years ago for the eukaryotes, now, you know, what, basically we're cutting it in half now to 1.5 billion, practically in half. That's quite a mistake. It's no rounding error. Let's just put it like that. I'll go with my gut. And I think this, socioeconomic one with the breadth and taste in music, I think that one's going to turn out to be the fiction, because I don't think it's just the higher, status. I think it's all across the board.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah. The first one here about the, impaired ability to identify odors and that as a predictor of death over a four-year follow-up. Well, first of all, if you're losing your sense of smell, you can't actually smell your self rotting, your own death, and therefore you won't go to the doctor, and then that's what kills you, right? That's how I think this works, right? Well, I mean,
before you turn to a zombie. Yeah.
What it's actually saying here is that, you know, as people grow older, their senses dull. And the dulling of your senses, like a dramatic dulling of your senses, could be an indicator that you know, other systems in your body or mind are failing. So I think that one is science. This next one about the music, the socioeconomic status correlation here, meaning that, you know, the higher you are up on the income scale, that you have a larger taste in music. You know, I'm going to agree with Evan. I think this one's the fake. I think that particularly today, with the ease, how easy it is for people to get their hands on pretty much any kind of music that they want at low, such an amazingly low cost. That idea alone squashes that for me. So I say that one's the fake.
All right. So that means that you all agree with the first one. So let's start there. A new study finds that an impaired ability to identify odors is associated with a significant increase in the risk of death over a 4-year follow-up. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Oh, I love being right.
Good job.
Hello. Yep.
I'm always right once a week.
You could look at it that way. So.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is also not the first study to show this. There was a study from last year which showed the same thing with very similar numbers. In fact, in this study, this is a 4-year follow-up, the mortality rate was 45% in participants with the lowest score on a 40-item smell test compared to 18%, so more than double of participants with the highest scores. And there was a dose-response curve. The worse your sense of smell, the higher your chance of death. So this seems to – it held out throughout all of the categories.
That's horrible. Like
more than doubling. The 2014 study that was published in PLOS One was a 5-year follow-up, and they showed a similar doubling, 19% versus 10%. Versus the healthy sense of smell for the impaired ones. Now, this is just a correlation. There's no direct cause and effect here. Nobody thinks that that's one's inability to smell causes them to die. There are a number of interesting hypotheses. So one possibility is that the sense of smell is the quote unquote canary in a coal mine, where it is just a marker that someone is not well overall. The olfactory tissue has stem cells that replace themselves frequently. So it's a very, sort of demanding high turnover tissue. And so it's certainly makes sense that if on a cellular level, somebody was not very healthy, that would suffer first. The other possibility, which is intriguing, is that people who are exposed to, say, cigarette smoke or maybe pollutants, that may harm their health and also their sense of smell. So it may just be a marker for exposure to airborne toxins. Or maybe it's both of those things. Who knows? So we don't really have data to tell us what the reason for the correlation is, but there's multiple studies now which show a very robust correlation between the decreased sense of smell and mortality. And I will add, this is only in an older population also, Bob, so it doesn't even apply. This is at your age. This is in older people. It hasn't really been studied in younger people.
Okay, that's another yay.
Yeah, so that was very interesting. All right, let's go on to the second one. Researchers find that higher socioeconomic status correlates with a significantly increased breadth of taste in music. Jay and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Bob, you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
It is the fiction.
Sorry, Bob. So what the research actually showed is that people of higher and lower socioeconomic status have the same breadth of taste in music. They just prefer different genres of music. So
I was kind of right.
Yeah, there. So what do you guys think are the genres? I'll just say it's not surprising, but what do you think were the genres of music associated with people of a lower socioeconomic class and education level?
They like hard rock, southern rock,
rap,
Bob, electronic dance music,
techno.
They liked the poor people were associated with liking country, disco, easy listening, golden oldies, heavy metal, and rap. So you guys got a few of those.
I think we pretty much,
All right. And then the high end, wealthier, better educated counterparts prefer.
Yes.
Which genres? Well, lovely.
Classical, of course, yes. And, yes.
Classical.
Quite well, sir.
Classical. We have, classical and, what's the other one? Oh, yeah.
Opera?
Classic.
Opera.
Right, operatic.
Yanni.
Oh, a Zamfir and the pan flute?
Zamfir.
Electronic dance music.
Here, classical, blues, jazz, opera, choral, pop, reggae, rock, world, and musical theater.
And interpretive dance.
Interpretive dance. So that's interesting.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Right. It's almost a cliche, right. You know what I mean?
Whatever.
You read it, you're like... So, let's go on to the third one. A new study changes the estimate for the evolution of eukaryotes from a maximum of 2.8 billion years ago to 1.5 billion years ago, 1.3 billion years later than previously thought. That one is, of course, science. And ironically, Bob, you absolutely nailed the reason for this change. It was the discrediting of prior data.
So, had to be. What the hell else could it be?
Yeah, you were right. Your analysis was spot on.
Spot on.
So that's very interesting, actually. So how do we know how old eukaryotic cells are? I mean, these are single-celled organisms. So a eukaryote is a cell that has a nucleus. So it could be single-celled or multicellular. We are eukaryotic, right? Our cells have nuclei, as opposed to cells that don't have nuclei. Those are prokaryotes like bacteria and archaea. So
there's lots of other distinguishing elements as well, but that's the key one right there.
That's the key. So, there's two types of evidence that have established the date for the first eukaryotes. The first type of evidence is microfossils. These were discovered in northern Australia, these like mats of algae, for example. So those date back to 1.5 billion years ago. But there's also chemical evidence. They detected steroids, like hormones, you know, in rock that was up to 2.8 billion years old. And this was taken as evidence of eukaryotes because eukaryotes are associated with the production of those particular molecules, steroids. That pushed the date back to between 2.5 and 2.8 billion years ago. However, scientists were concerned that the steroids that were being detected in 2.8 billion year old soil or rock was a contaminant. So they extracted ultra clean samples, where they did everything they could to minimize any contaminants. And lo and behold, they had no steroids in them. They didn't detect them even at, like they said, picoliter levels.
Oh.
So yeah, they were cleaner than they even thought they were going to get. So that erases the chemical evidence, the biogeochemistry evidence for the origin of eukaryotes. And if you eliminate that, the oldest evidence we have is the microfossils from 1.5 billion years ago. So that moves it, our evidence, oldest evidence for eukaryotes to 1.5 billion years. All right, Evan, give us a quote this week.
Here is this week's quote. Belief is so often the death of reason.
Very short and to the point.
Summed up quite nicely. But who said that?
Oh.
Well, that was disgraced ex-Maester Qyburn. From Game of Thrones, Season 5, Episode 8, called Hard Home.
Yeah, the one that, we were chatting about at the beginning of the show.
Yes.
That quote leaped out to every skeptic I know. It's a great, pithy quote.
Oh, thanks to Andrew in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Calgary!
For suggesting that we use it this week. Oh, and did you know the actor Anton Lesser is not related to Anton Mesmer?
I did know that, in fact, yes.
Okay. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you did. Maybe you didn't. But now you know.
I have to teach you how surnames work, Evan. All right. Well,
Anton.
Thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome, Steve.
You're welcome, brother.
Thanks, Steve. Especially the science or fiction.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.